Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
I don't necessarily think they're going to come on board to our plan, just as we're not going to come on to their plan. It's going to be a compromise, a collaboration. We've reached out to the Senate and to the governor's office multiple times, and they have decided to go it alone.
I support the Trump energy agenda completely, which prioritizes fossil fuel as the backbone of our power grid. We should be opening new fossil fuel plants, not closing them.
It was riddled with loopholes that would allow Chinese Communist Party proxies to own land on behalf of the government. And it didn't address any other foreign adversaries who may be seeking to do Arizonans harm.
We need to continue to support our local law enforcement. This type of proposal, the pay is something that is needed. It's been needed for a very long time.
By exercising his constitutional rights and his rights as a United States senator to ask some questions of government officials, he was doing his job. His job is oversight. Oversight of the Department of Homeland Security.
And with me to talk about budget talks apparently hitting high gear, two new Freedom Caucus candidates and more are Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning.
And Carl Gentles of the Gentles Agency. Carl, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy Friday the 13th.
I didn't realize it is indeed Friday the 13th. Seriously. Well, so maybe that's a good introduction to the first thing we're going to talk about. Lawmakers at the Capitol on a Friday, doesn't happen all the time, to discuss a budget. The House is scheduled to vote on its budget that went through the Appropriations Committee yesterday. Senate, there's talk that the Senate is going to unveil its budget proposal today. We are about 2 weeks away from the end of the fiscal year, and the House and Senate are not on the same page.
Yeah, a little concerning, right? Typically, when you have majorities of the same party, and in the situation we have Republican majorities in the legislature, which we've had for a while, usually they get on the same page on a budget earlier in the session, right? Mm-hmm. And then it always comes down to negotiating with the governor when it comes to revenue and spending priorities and whatnot. Obviously, it's been more challenging the past few years with divided government and a Democratic governor. But this is the first time in a while where the House and Senate have gone this far into a legislative session without being on the same page on just, one, a general budget approach, and two, the priorities. And so we've seen this in the past when the House and Senate haven't been on the same page. One chamber will forge ahead with their budget plan and start things rolling in a more public forum. This is probably the best time to do it because, as you mentioned, we're 2 weeks away from the end of the fiscal year. But those conversations about a compromise need to start happening, or else this budget is, as the governor mentioned publicly yesterday, DOA, and the Senate has some other priorities that they want.
Yeah, the governor said yesterday, as Lorna alluded to, Carl, that the House budget is not one that she is willing to sign. The interesting thing, and Lorna alluded to this, there are different approaches here. The Senate is trying to do some, like, kind of what they did a couple of years ago, where, you know, they divide up a pot of money between the House, the Senate, and the governor. The House, and we had Representative Matt Gress on yesterday saying he's not down with that. He's not up for that. So in addition to having maybe different spending priorities, it sounds like they have to reconcile these different approaches.
Well, they are. I mean, first of all, they've got to take a different approach from the Republican side and not making this basically a demand letter, as ranking Democrat Stephanie Stahl Hamilton said. I mean, we know it's in her words, sham budget. I think she even threw Disney in there this year, which is pretty incredible. So there, there's a lot in that bill that's just not going to make it past the budget's not going to make it past the governor's desk. I mean, so you're talking about three major things: cutting K-12 education funding again, in some respect, where you're cutting out money for books and supplies and that sort of thing. You're talking about cutting Medicare cuts and also DACA money. So, I mean, they've got to do some negotiating. It has to be done in good faith, and it's just not there right now. In fact, I think the Republicans are actually, gone on vacation and at their cabins for weeks before they came back, and now they're finally getting back to the real business of the state. So we've got to have some negotiation in some real good faith.
Lorna, is it possible that by the House unveiling its budget, moving it through appropriations, voting on it today, Does that kickstart negotiations? Like, does that help in any way bring the Senate and maybe the governor to the table in the sense that now saying, okay, this is a budget we can get through this chamber. These are our priorities. Let's talk about it.
Definitely. Since they're the first to kind of go public and start moving, it does put added pressure on the governor's office and to the Senate, right? Up until now, everything's been happening behind closed doors and negotiations and conversations. So us in the public, we've heard rumors, but no one's seen anything until the House unveiled their budget earlier this week, and we'll vote on it today. It's always a delicate dance, right? Anytime you're negotiating with a budget, regardless of who's in leadership and who the governor is, you always have to balance the different priorities. And so now that the House has what's much considered a conservative budget, and the governor has been outspoken with what she's opposed to, now the conversations are going to happen of what can she live with, what can these Republicans in the House, forego and maintain the votes that they need. You're going to lose some Freedom Caucus members, right, when you do that. And what are you going to be able to bring on that's going to bring in Democrats? And so 2 weeks is a short time period, but we've seen this in the past. As soon as you reach a deal, things move quickly, yeah. Right? And so at least the conversations are happening publicly and pressure's on all parties.
Well, and to your point about maybe losing some of the Freedom Caucus members, presumably, I mean, this has been sort of the governor's MO so far. She's not going to sign something if it doesn't have some Democratic support. So yes, you're going to lose some Freedom Caucus members, but you also, if you're the House, probably have to have a budget that at least some Democrats can vote for, right?
Definitely. And again, that's what the delicate balance and dance is. And especially, I mean, the governor has been criticized by her colleagues in the Democratic Party in the past for signing onto budgets that they didn't feel really reflected the priorities of the Democratic Party, right? So I think she's being cognizant of that during this cycle, making sure that a lot more of those priorities are included in whatever the final budget looks like. But yeah, it's really comes down to 16, 31, and 1, right? And whatever configuration you need to get there. And sometimes people feel a little bit more beholden, thinking that they're going to be that deciding vote, and they get rolled and they find someone else elsewhere that they can get on board. And so We'll see what happens next week after if the House does pass out their budget today, yeah. And where the conversations go.
Well, and Carl, the conventional wisdom, what we keep hearing from legislators is that next week will be the week that they will get it done, because as we've been talking about, the fiscal year ends on the 30th. There's some members who are going to be leaving before that for some personal commitments. So, like, yes, once there is an agreement, to Lorna's point, it can happen pretty much in a day, basically, getting the budget done. But it seems as though there's still some negotiations to be done here. Can it happen in this amount of time?
I think it can. But, you know, you've got to strip out the things that, the Democrats are against, or at least dial that back a little bit. Right. And of course, you're going to have to keep in elements of that the Freedom Caucus and Republicans really want. So there is a delicate balance. Lorna is very, very right about that. The question is, where is that balance going to be? And what are Democrats Democrats going to be willing to, stomach in this next budget cycle? So,
all right. So we are still working in this legislative session. Oh, did you want to add
something? Yeah, I just wanted to say, it'll be interesting to see when the Senate does release publicly their plan that, there have been conversations that they've been, deliberating with the governor's office, how different that is from the House,
yeah.
And how far apart we actually are. A lot of this is speculation right now, and obviously there's internal dynamics and personalities at play. But usually when you're negotiating a budget, it's honestly like a handful of issues that are really at play. The majority of the state budget from year to year is pretty much the same. And
yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how far away we are.
Absolutely. So, Lorna, let me stick with you to talk about next year's election. We're already talking about next year's election. The Freedom Caucus, we've mentioned them already today, has brought forward two candidates to run for Corporation Commission, which is an important state or agency, quasi-agency. I'm not really sure how you describe it.
No one knows how to describe it.
Well, that's exactly it,
yeah.
Right? Like, they have these incredible powers, but very few people know what they actually do. This is, kind of a down ballot race. And we heard from one of those candidates, Ralph Heap, a state representative, talking about wanting more fossil fuel power plants in this state. I'm curious how, we're still obviously very far out, but, we have two Republicans taking on primarying two Republicans here. How do you see that shaking out?
It's always unfortunate when we have, especially for statewide offices like Corporation Commission, which, as you mentioned, are down ballot races that don't usually get a lot of attention mm-hmm. from your average voter, where there's kind of this internal, political infighting and whatnot. And so it makes for a very expensive primary. Which then they're going to have to face, you know, Democratic opponents in the general, right? Voters aren't paying any attention to this right now. You mentioned that, you know, 2026 election, and everyone's kind of like rolling their eyes on about everything right now because people are still recovering from 2024. But when it comes to the Corporation Commission, as somebody who's been in this field for almost 20 years now, I don't even fully understand the day-to-day operations of the Corporation Commission because it's so technical and complex when it comes to regulating utilities in this state. And so I think there is a lot of misinformation out there about the positions of the current corporation commissioners and votes they have taken and, you know, rate increases from utilities. This is very nuanced and very complex, right? And so I think there's just a lot of misinformation out there, and it's led to the situation now where there's a lot of Republican infighting going into 2026 for these races.
Yeah, I mean, Corporation Commission is one of the most important commissions that affects every single Arizonan that nobody really knows about, mm-hmm. to your point. I mean, it's incredibly important around utilities and other services. So, I mean, you really should pay attention to this. I think what's going on is really more of an infight, like Lorna said, about, you know, how far right should that Corporation Commission be, right? So I think the two candidates are essentially being put up by, you know, Jake Hoffman to push the Corporation Commission a little bit further right than what it is. And so, I mean, that's really the infighting that's going on. Now, you know better than I do, but I think, you know, as you're looking at this, you know, the question is, how much control of that corporation commission will somebody like a Jake Hoffman and his, you know, his group have over the commission?
Well, and Carl, this is these are elections for CorpCom that Democrats have won in somewhat recent years.
Absolutely.
Like they've had members on this. I wonder though, since it's so down ballot, even if you know Freedom Caucus members are the Republican nominees, you know, the conventional wisdom is that a Freedom Caucus, you know, further left or further right candidate in the general election makes it hard to get elected. But I wonder if that's mitigated somewhat by the fact that this is so far down ballot. Does it make it harder maybe for Democrats to win these races, even if they're going up against, you know, Freedom Caucus members or you know, more ideological candidates?
It does a little bit. But, you know, Democrats have won statewide in this last election. I mean, their whole five statewide offices right now. So, you know,
those are more at the top of the ticket, though.
And well, they were. But, you know, there's a draft that comes from that. Right. And it really does depend on the quality of the candidate. Right. So to get down to the ballot and, of course, the education that happens and making sure people go down the ballot and vote the way, you know, vote down the ballot. So I think, you know, Democrats have a good chance to, you know, put some Dems back on the Corporation Commission. I think having balance on that commission especially is a good thing. It really is, because it does affect such a wide number of people on their everyday lives. So, you know, we'll see what happens if the Freedom Caucus is able to knock off what I would, you know, it's hard to say that they're, you know, less conservative, but or less, you know, to the right. But we'll see what happens. This is a strange time we're in.
I think it's going to be difficult. You know, we'll see what comes out of the Republican primary. But I think a lot of these Republicans are going to be talking about similar things: low utility rates, you know, different types of energy consumption in the state, whatnot. I don't think there's going to be much difference when it comes to the messaging of these Republicans, because mm-hmm. I believe at the end of the day they believe in similar things. I think that's going to be very difficult for Democrats during the general when you are defending so many statewide seats. And you're trying to pick something up, there's only so much money to go around. And there's already a lot of dysfunction within the Democrat infrastructure in the state, where it's going to come down to, will they have the resources and the infrastructure to actually knock off two Republicans from the Corporation Commission on a down ballot race?
Carl, let me start with you about Governor Katie Hobbs signing a statement with other Democratic governors, basically supporting California Governor Gavin Newsom in his opposition to the use of the National Guard in L.A. Of course, a judge yesterday said that the president could not federalize the National Guard without the governor's permission. That decision, though, is on hold temporarily. There's a lot of sort of legal machinations here. I'm wondering, though, like, you know, the governor, of course, is up for reelection next year. So it's hard. I mean, not saying that there was a political motive, this, you know, we can't get inside anybody's head. But like, when you look at this move through the lens of the governor running for reelection, what comes to mind for you?
You know, it's a really challenging issue, because of course, you know, we've got to ensure that, first of all, we got to ensure that, you know, people have their right to protest and to protest without the use of force against them. And so, you know, let me just start by saying that I grew up in an Air Force family. My father's 33-year military veteran, retired as a chief master sergeant. I'm married to a 29-year Army reservist who just retired. And so service is a part of our family, and I know service is a part of all of those people that are out there in the National Guard defending the right to use their voice. And so the challenge that we have is that now we've got the use of the military against our own people. And even though that is something that, I don't think it should be occurring. I think it's absolutely wrong. I think when you talk about governors of supporting Gavin Newsom, I think by and large, most governors would probably say that's not the right use of military force. And so first, I just don't think it has any place in our democracy to start with. And you know, Trump is like, you know, this effort is like, Trump is like a velociraptor in Jurassic Park. He just keeps going up to the edge of the fence and see what he can test out. And that's what's going on in this issue and many other issues that we've seen.
Did not have a Jurassic Park reference on my bingo card for today. So thank you for that,
Anything
Carl.
Can happen on Friday the 13th.
Seriously. Right. So, Lorna, I'm curious about something that Carl mentioned, which is sort of the precedent of the president. And, of course, this has happened very rarely, but it has happened where a president has federalized the National Guard without the consultation or permission of a governor. Mm-hmm. I wonder, though, you know, the Democratic governors, of course, are supporting Gavin Newsom on this. But I wonder, even if you are a Republican governor, is there any thought of I don't mind what they're doing here. But if the roles were reversed, I sure wouldn't like it if a Democratic president federalized the National Guard and sent them to my state to deal with an issue that is a hot button issue here.
I mean, there's always that that tension between state and federal powers and whatnot. But I do think the difference is, and a Republican governor would say, well, I wouldn't have allowed the disorderly conduct and the violence to have ensued, right? I mean, that's the argument that's being made for why the National Guard was deployed, was that the situation became untenable within Los Angeles. And there was the perception that the mayor of L.A. and the governor of L.A. was having law enforcement be a little bit hands-off when it came to this situation, right? And so from the president's perspective, the National Guard was being deployed to maintain law and order, not to quell protests, not to stop people from – not to attack protesters – but to protect law enforcement who was being attacked by folks, right? And so I think that's kind of where there's a nuance between a Democrat governor and a Republican governor perspective is, you know, we've even seen that here when, you know, there was a misunderstanding about a situation here in Peoria where people started attacking Peoria police. I mean, the governor even came out quickly to clarify what the situation was. It was a drug situation, not ICE enforcement. But I think Republican governors would probably be a little bit more forward and proactive when it comes to maintaining law and order and making sure that law enforcement or ICE officials aren't being attacked by protesters.
There's no indication, though, that the police did not have the situation under control. There's really no indication of that. I think the administration was looking for an opportunity to show this use of force, if you will. And so there's a perfect opportunity for the administration to send in the National Guard to show their strongman kind of positioning and to try to send a message that anybody that opposes the administration's agenda is going to be dealt with. I mean, we're seeing this across the board. We're seeing this with all of these ICE raids that are going on. You're seeing ICE agents running down migrants in strawberry fields. It's incredible. And so I think he was really looking for an opportunity to show this force. I mean, he's got we know that he's really loves what, a foreign dictator is doing. He wants to bring in an element of that. And, of course, we're waiting to see what happens tomorrow in this parade. And for me, I hope it rains so that we don't have to deal with it so much and maybe it gets washed out. But, I think the administration has been looking for this opportunity to really show their force.
Lorna, of course, there's the big military parade tomorrow in D.C., but also large-scale protests planned in places across the country, including a few places here in Arizona. Mm-hmm. If you are an elected official and you've worked for governors, you've worked for other elected officials, what is the thought process in terms of, I assume there's some kind of hope that, like, it doesn't get violent, that things go smoothly, that there doesn't have to be National Guard called up to your city or your state?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's always the hope when there's large demonstrations and protests, that things stay peaceful, right? But you have to prepare for the worst case scenario, right? And that's what every governor or local elected official, unfortunately, has to do in this day and age, because we've seen too many demonstrations, unfortunately, turn violent and whatnot. And so there's contingency plans always in place. I'm sure the governor and, you know, whether it's the mayor of Phoenix and the other municipalities where there's these planned protests are working together and collaborating, and law enforcement is. But hopefully we won't be seeing anything on the evening news about any kind of violent protests this
weekend. Do those plans include potentially, not specifically this one, because we have no idea, but mm-hmm. in the past, like, would the governor be consulting with, for example, the adjutant general of the Arizona National Guard just in case?
I can't speak to those specifics, maybe now because of the dynamics that we are, or the climate that we're in right now, but definitely the Department of Public Safety would be communicating with all of the local law enforcement to make sure that resources are deployed where needed if a situation were to unfold.
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense, right? Because we do want the protests to be peaceful. We don't want any violence, and I don't expect any here in Arizona, but, you know, you never know. And so it makes sense to have a contingency plan, but working very actively with the National Guard and other agencies as a precaution just in case. And then at the request of the governor, then they deploy, not just deploying without the consent and advice of the sitting governor, which is what happened in California, which has led to all this chaos.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Carl Gentles, Lorna Romero-Ferguson, thanks to you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.